This time of year, a good hoodie is absolutely essential. And the American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime. With timeless style, heavyweight fleece, and durable details, you can depend on it for years to come. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life. The American Giant Classic Full Zip. And save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code CLASSIC24 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code CLASSIC24.
How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO.
Charles Monroe Brown was a lot of things. Inventor. He held a patent for a shuffle hoe. Politician. He was a Florida state senator and ran for the governor's office unsuccessfully in 1904. Pioneer. He was one of the state's first citrus planters. Civil War veteran. He served in the Confederate Army in his mid to late teens. But that's not why we're going to be talking about Charles Monroe Brown today. Because all of those things took place outside of Dade County. In fact, most of Monroe Brown's life was lived outside of Dade County. He wasn't a native Miamian. But he did die in Miami in 1927. The Miami Herald reported that Civil War veterans, Confederate veterans, were attending the funeral, which was going to take place at the Shenandoah Presbyterian Church on Southwest 8th Street and 20th Avenue. He had become a Miamian later in life, leaving farming and politics behind to create the Dade County Furniture Company. But we're not really going to talk about that either. We're going to talk about his house. The Charles Monroe Brown House was located near what's now Omni in downtown Miami. At the time, it was a community called Miramar. And the Brown House was intended to be a standout. It was built out of oolitic limestone. This is one of our most recognizable, strongly identifiable stones commonly found in Florida architecture. And was built with this very familiar outside look of coral rock and an interior designed with an influence of Japan. Brown lived here for only a few years of his life, eventually selling it to citrus grower Montellus Clifton Hardee in 1921. But the name Charles Monroe Brown stuck, and the famous faces and important people that would come through Hardee's home would eventually be part of this long lineage connecting back to Charles Monroe Brown, a lineage that was determined to be so important that in 1984, the Dade Heritage Trust literally moved heaven and earth to save the house. On a sunny Sunday morning, the Dade Heritage Trust, alongside a moving company, resources from the state of Florida, and local municipalities, were going to pick up the Brown House and move it from downtown and Omni to Watson Island, attempting to create a reserve on the then underdeveloped island for historic preservation. There were only two problems: wind and gravity. And those two problems combined to create one heck of a mess today, this day in Miami history, October 7th, 1984, the day that part of the Charles Monroe Brown House collapsed all across the MacArthur Causeway, leaving a historical mess for South Florida to reckon with. The high times and low times, all in the nightlife. For those of you that have listened to This Day in Miami History for any length at all, You know that our topics range from the very big and well-known events that I want to dive into in further detail, to the very obscure events that just kind of cross my radar without really anticipating it. Well, this is definitely an episode that is part of Category 2, and I want to walk you through how I got there because, I don't know, I find it interesting. Hopefully you do too. I followed a Facebook group. I follow a number of Facebook groups related to Miami and Florida history, and a woman named Amy Morera Perez shared a link last month to a YouTube video, and that YouTube video entitled "A Gust of Wind and Miami Loses a Landmark" was from our friends at the Wolfson Archive on YouTube. And the first frames are exactly what it sounds like, the wreckage of a house spread across a large highway. And in watching the video from the Wolfson Archive, the reporting from 1984, we learn a little bit more about this house that has apparently collapsed across a giant highway in Miami.
Just feet away from its final destination, one of Dade's most historic houses fell off its dolly, shattering into a million pieces. The 69-year-old mansion, known as the Brown House, was being relocated to make way for a luxury hotel. At less than 5 miles per hour, the 2.5-story house was being moved piecemeal down Biscayne Boulevard and over the MacArthur Causeway when the accident occurred.
In getting to know more about this story and watching the video, there is a individual interviewed the head of the Dade Heritage Trust at the time, a man named Don Slesnick.
A gust of wind caught the house while they were trying to regain balance on a little bit of an incline here coming off MacArthur Causeway, and the whole house went over. In fact, there were about 10 men under the house working on it when it went over, and luckily all of them were saved.
Now, what's interesting about Don Slesnick is I know Don Slesnick. Don Slesnick, if you know anything about South Florida politics, was the mayor of Coral Gables for a decade, from 2001 to 2011. He was also the president of the Dade Heritage Trust. And so anytime I get to talk to someone with firsthand knowledge of a particular event in Miami history, especially someone with a background in historical preservation, I can't let the opportunity pass. So I reached out to Mayor Slesnick and asked if he had a few moments to talk about this particular odd event in South Florida history, but also a little bit about historical preservation in South Florida and in Florida on a larger basis. So I hope you enjoy our conversation, and I'll rejoin you towards the end of the episode just to close things out. But until then, here's my interview with former Coral Gables mayor and former president of the Dade Heritage Trust, Don Slesnick. Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us today for what I think will be a really interesting discussion. I'm joined by a man that has a remarkable resume and that's really been involved in kind of all aspects of Greater Miami for all his adult life. And that man is Don Slesnick. Don, how are you doing today?
Doing great. It's good to be with you, and always fun to talk about Miami and its history and what people are doing to save it.
Yes, wonderful. So speaking on that, we're going to get into the hook of the conversation in just a minute, but if you wouldn't mind just for a moment, for the benefit of our listeners and for me, to talk a little bit about your relationship with Miami broadly, and then your relationship with historical preservation in Miami.
Well, I grew up here. So we moved here when I was 10 years old. And so I consider myself a Miami native, even though I wasn't born here. And I am a proud graduate of the public school system, including Miami Senior High, which, of course, if you go to Miami High, that's a start in preservation right there, because I think it was Thomas Jefferson said that, you know, great buildings help produce great people, but you couldn't help but be inspired by going to such an incredible building as Miami Senior High. And then even though I went off to college in Virginia, the University of Virginia, which, of course, again, you're immersed in a preserved historic site, and then back to Gainesville for law school, and then to the Army for 3 years. Miami was still my home of record. As soon as I was out of the Army, returned here, and Jeanette and I settled in Coral Gables immediately. And so we were back home. I was back home. And therefore, things that happened in Miami to me are part of my life. They're watching Miami evolve and from where it's been to where it's going, and yet trying to save its roots so that people 100 years from now can appreciate where we came from and how we got here. And so I sort of evolved after I got back and got started in my legal career and being active in the city, well, in everything, in City of Miami, the City of Coral Gables, and so forth. I became very active in preservation, which I thought was an important aspect of our lives, and became involved in Dade Heritage Trust. Later, became president of Dade Heritage Trust. Helped found their foundation. They have a foundation of Dade Heritage Trust. Helped do that. Became a member of the Miami-Dade County. Of course, at the time it was Metro Dade County Historic Preservation Board, and served of its, as its chairman for a couple of terms, and then went to the state and became a founding member of the State Historic Preservation Advisory Council, and served as its chairman for a couple of terms, and later became president of the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation. So, you know, my outlook and I outview about saving our history has extended to the various borders of Florida and all parts thereof. And to this day, I still serve on the University of Florida's Historic St. Augustine Board, which has helped really save the historic assets of downtown St. Augustine and its historic district. That gives you a little bit of background.
Yeah, just a little bit. Those are some pretty darn good bona fides when it comes to historical preservation, which is exceptional. And thank you for the decades of work you've done on that front. So you, as you mentioned, you're a
Well,
member.
let me say this. You're very welcome. I appreciate your thanks, but believe me, it's been a labor of love. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
That's wonderful to hear. And usually when I've had the pleasure to encounter folks that do this work, that's always that's the only way the work gets done. I found is that if you don't have just this kind of this fire in you to like you got to do this for to scratch whatever itch you have, it doesn't get done. So you're not the first, but it definitely it's obvious how much it does matter to you.
And one of my proudest achievements is the fact that Jeanette and I turned out a daughter whose profession is historic preservation, educated in preservation, and who has served in numerous jobs. Currently, she's the historic preservation officer for the city of Gainesville, but she served 9 years down here as the chief of historic preservation for Miami-Dade County, and I think 4 years in the city of Miami as preservation officer. So of all the things I've done in preservation, turning out my daughter is the proudest. So,
That's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good one.
how do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So, yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
So you mentioned that you were a member and then later the president of the Dade Heritage Trust. And that's kind of where we're going to zoom in on today for a little bit. In that time, when you're on the board and then eventually serving as president, it's a turbulent time for Miami. It's a time of significant growth for Miami. And particularly that growth is focusing on really the oldest area in town when it comes to American settlement, which is by the Miami River, Brickell and downtown. And can you, before we zoom in on the Monroe House, the Monroe Brown House, can you talk a little bit about what that was like as, you know, you have governmental leaders looking at Miami, you know, in particular, I'm thinking of Maurice Ferre, who's like really looking at Miami's developing as kind of the capital of Latin America and the financial real estate development that's necessary to make that happen, coming into conflict with those early roots in places like Brickell and downtown.
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, Miami is at the heart of growth in Florida. And it is a city that has always depended on the influx of money and people to keep it growing. I mean, maybe some people would wish it hadn't grown, but it is, listen, we're such an attractive community as far as trade routes to the Caribbean and to Latin America, as far as our climate, our subtropical climate. And you sort of knew as the economy in the United States grew, there had to be an attraction for people to move here. I mean, it provides incredible opportunities for business, and of course, it provides a healthy atmosphere for life. And so, yes, we have been the target of much investment in real estate, much development, and so it becomes harder and harder to preserve the things which show where we came from because of the rising price. I mean, if you own a historic building in downtown Miami, that is a very fine building and it's useful, but it could be tripled in size and economic impact. And the price of the land has gone so high that to hold on to it becomes a financial burden. It's very difficult to try to save things that are built environment. I mean, as you know, I mean, one of the greatest historic monuments in downtown Miami is our courthouse, and how hard it's becoming just to even save our courthouse and the pressures of saying that it's, unhealthy environment there and that it has to be removed and replaced and so forth. So we fight every time there comes one of these battles. There are people who at least have the courage to stand up and fight and say, you know what? There's a lot of places that we can invest money. There's a lot of places to build 90-story condominiums. We need to save a few of these sites. I mean, one of the greatest, and going back to the original occupants of this land, the American Native Indians that occupied the land, the Tequestas and so forth. I mean, the Miami Circle was a major battle to save that piece of land. Of course, it still is quite, I'm not sure controversial is the right word, but it's very much concerned that we haven't done more at the Miami Circle than we have. We haven't actually made it into the kind of site of educational experience that it should be, but at least it's saved and set aside. And then just recently, I read more articles about the same exact type of sites that were found on the other side of the Miami River, which now have large buildings, but they had made deals to, in order to get the permits to build those buildings, to save the archaeological sites underneath the buildings and to put them in such a situation as they could be seen. A lot of questions have arisen recently as to whether they lived up to those obligations or not. So we're starting way back and trying to save the places that were important, of spiritual importance, of agricultural importance, of importance to their civilization, of the original settlers of this area, which preceded the European invasion and so forth. And then, of course, as we move along, we've tried to save in northern Florida a lot of the Spanish settlements, St. Augustine, Mission San Luis, and Tallahassee, and so forth. So, I mean, we start there, and then we work up to Miami, which is the late, the 1800s and the early 1900s. And there are things which have show where we came from, how we got here, and what the implications were of the early development. We've lost a great deal of that, but we've successfully saved some of it, and that's to our credit, I think. I mean, when I grew up here, and I think people listening to your podcast can remember going down Brickell. It was all giant mansions, beautiful mansions. I mean, we used to take Sunday drives down Brickell to see these incredible mansions that face the bay and Brickell Avenue. And of course, all but one is gone now, and the only one that's left is like the clubhouse for a large condominium. So the whole character of that area has changed. And, it's great for the economy, it's great for business and everything, but we've lost a lot of the things that really kind of made Miami, if you look back at old movies or anything, what the essence of the feeling of Miami, of that subtropical paradise getaway. We're now a very great economic engine. So now we're a banking center and the Miami skyline has changed, but we did a lot to try to do different things. And one of the things, of course, is the headquarters of the Dade Heritage Trust, which is the Dr. James Jackson Surgery. Which was moved long ago, before day or just, from up near Jackson Memorial Hospital on the river down to where it sits now, just off Brickell, but has been a constant effort to save that piece of property and his surgery building as the headquarters of Dade Heritage Trust. And that's nestled among a lot of brand new condominiums and office buildings. It has a little piece of history there that I think it's a great demonstration of what I'm trying to say, is that as you look around to the built environment there, just focusing on that one little historic building brings back memories of where we've come from, where how we got here, and what our founders did to make this a livable community. And that probably brings us to the Brown House, which is what you wanted to talk about.
If you're looking for another job, I could use a second producer to help me out, because that is a perfect segue into this specific event. So I'm going to tell you about kind of how I came across this. In making this show, I have this wonderful spreadsheet that I have, 12 different tabs for 12 months, 30, 31 days. I've got shows lined up that I want to do. So usually what happens is something else comes up and I'm like, oh, this is it. And literally, I was scrolling through Facebook, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and the Wolfson Archive, which is like my number one resource for finding stuff for the show, just shared this video. And it's a video of a bunch of rubble on the MacArthur Causeway. Like, oh, what's that? And then I look in it, oh, it's this historic house that was being moved to Watson Island. And then lo and behold, who pops up in the middle of the video but a guy I know, Don Selesnik, talking about this house. I'm like, what on earth happened here? And so the house that we're speaking of is was known as the Charles Monroe Brown House. While he wasn't the only owner, he was the builder of the home in the 19 teens, a former state senator. He did most of his work in Ocala, but moved to Miami and kind of established a bit of a furniture empire before he passed in the 1920s. But it's this beautiful coral home that's constructed and is in downtown. And again, in the middle of the 1980s, it's 1984, there's all this financialization going on and a desire for the development of new condos, office buildings, that kind of thing. And the Dade Heritage Trust is involved, and you're involved in essentially trying to strike a compromise to keep this house in existence, but to get it moved and to basically move it to Watson Island, which at that point, now it has the Children's Museum and Jungle Island. But at that point, there were still these plans in the air to do something with it, but it really hadn't come to fruition yet. And this was ultimately one of the things that was being proposed, is to kind of make a historical, almost like a historical hitch post with this building to attract people to the island. Not to spoil too much of your side of it, because you know a heck of a lot more than I do. But can you tell me a little bit about this process of deciding what to do with it and getting to the day of the move?
It was on Biscayne Boulevard, just off Biscayne Boulevard in the Omni area. So it was north of the Venetian Causeway. Well, the Omni area, as you said, like Brickell, was a very historic moment in time for the city of Miami. There were beautiful homes just north of where the Omni Hilton Hotel has been planted, and most of them had been removed. One of the famous ones was the one that the lady failed to sell it to the developers of the Omni, and it was nestled in the parking garage corner for years. I'm not quite sure if it's still there or not, but it was quite funny. But this was just north of that, and it was a beautiful, large coral rock home with something that was very interesting, very Oriental features, Oriental roofline, Oriental tiles. And so it was a kind of a popular motif at the time, was to incorporate not only the Mediterranean feel of the coral rock house, but Oriental accoutrements. So we wanted to save the house, and there was no way that the developers of that area were going to save the house, because it was going to be built on, and it was going to be developed, and it was going to become a big building site. So we raised the money. We worked very hard. As you can imagine, this is not an inexpensive project. We had decided that we, City of Miami gave us land over on Watson Island, and the Japanese garden was already out there. And so this was going to be a complement to that. And it was going to be a really beautiful setting and on the bay. And it would be a gathering place and a historic building for meetings and for various, you know, there were all kinds of plans that it could be. It could have been a site for holding little gatherings and so forth. It could have been a catering site, but it was just a gorgeous, gorgeous home. And one of the other people that lived in that house was a former Cuban president had who had come to Miami and lived in the house before his death. So we raised the money. It was not easy. It was a lot of money at the time. I can't remember how much that was. But it was not only the move, but we had to have the city of Miami, we had to remove all the streetlights. We had to remove the streetlights and the lampposts from Biscayne Boulevard down to the MacArthur, and then make all those preparations. And of course, the day of the move, everything had to be closed. We had to close up downtown Miami. I mean, it was a big, big process. And we chose movers who were very well known and had moved houses for like 100 years here and had never, ever had a problem. And this was a pretty big move, though. And I think that it was misjudged as to the amount of tilt and amount of elevation of the first bridge across on the MacArthur going over to Watson Island, because everything was working well. We, by the way, they had to split the house into three pieces. Very interesting process. They had to lift the house up, number one. You had to lift it up, number two, split it into three pieces, and then move each piece separately. And so everything was going fine until we got to the top of the first bridge with one of the pieces. Don't remember whether it was the first or second piece to be moved, but it came crumbling down. Now, they had closed off that we were moving it in the westbound lane, which is on the north side, and they had not closed off the eastbound traffic. I mean, this was like a terrible decision on the part of the authorities. So we're moving this gigantic thing across the bridge in the westbound north lanes when it came crumbling down. And thank God that no one was killed or injured. But I think one worker was slightly injured. But I mean, the traffic that had been coming just so happened that there was a break in the traffic and it didn't crumble on oncoming cars. So we lost the big piece of the house, a big piece. And the moving company said that it was a gust of wind or it was some act of God because they didn't want us to sue them and blame them. I think it was misjudged on what they were doing, to be honest. But we, Dade Area Trust is a community group. It doesn't have deep pockets for lawyers. And there wasn't much to be done, anyways, because you're not going to reconstruct this gigantic piece of Coral Rock House. And without that piece, there was no sense in having the house. And so the whole project went down, and I would say in smoke, but it went down and rumbled, as you said. And it was just a very sad moment. We were all wearing, in fact, I'm sorry that I didn't bring it, but I still have my t-shirt that we were wearing saying, "I moved the Brown House." Of course, that was premature. I still
In
have that.
fairness, you did move it. It just didn't
Yeah.
arrive to where you wanted it to go.
That's true. That's true. It was very sad. I mean, it was a lot of money down the drain, lots of money. Paul Thompson was our executive director at the time. Paul now lives in North Georgia. I stay in touch with him. But Paul and I had a number of adventures in preservation during those days. This was one of them. This was not a happier moment. It was a very sad moment. But we had tried. We had tried to do the right thing. We tried to do something that was positive. So we never ever second guessed our motives, and we never second guessed our effort. But we obviously not only second guessed, but mourned our defeat. It just was a sad ending to a. But there's another project that we dealt with that I think you'd be interested in, and again, not totally successful, but partially, and that was the Ryan Motor Company building on the river. Ryan Motor Company was a 1920s Ford dealership down on I think it's Second South West Second and the river. It's where the big building was built to house the City of Miami administration, and it had been occupied by Florida Power and Light for a long time as their downtown headquarters, and so it's a was a beautiful semicircular building with great columns. It was such a classic, classic building. Nothing else in downtown Miami was like it. And so FP&L decided that they wanted to sell it And it was built with sea salt, and therefore it was falling apart. It was going to fall down and be dangerous. Well, first of all, we didn't think that the right analysis had been made. And secondly, we wanted to save the building. And that was a time, everybody talks about something when they had civil disobedience in their blood. Well, this was my civil disobedience. Paul Thompson and I went down and stood in front of the bulldozers. We actually put ourselves in front of the bulldozers, and we refused to move. And we wanted to save the building, and we were doing our little act of so FPNL sent Larry Adams. I'll still never forget, first time I met Larry Adams. Larry Adams, vice president of FPL, came roaring out to the site to encourage us to move or else have us arrested. We didn't save the building. What we saved was, and you've mentioned Wilson already, what we saved was, first of all, there was this beautiful Peki cypress ceilings, cross beam ceilings with beautiful paintings in between floor to scenes. We saved the ceiling, which is now on the third floor, I think, or the fourth floor of the Wilsonian on Miami Beach. And we had these incredible giant wrought iron chandeliers, which are also at the Wilsonian. You'll see them at the Wilsonian. At least last time I was out there, at least I saw one of them. There was a couple, I believe, but one of them. So two of our efforts are at the Wilsonian, and I think they have one of these too. The columns were very unusual. They bulged in the middle. I'm not quite sure. I'm not good enough in architecture to tell you exactly the style of the columns, but I think they had Doric capitals, but they had these bulge in the middle, and they had these beautiful bronze expansion bands around each column. They were beautiful expand. We saved those. I think the Wilsonian has one of those, but I think we also auctioned off some of those to raise money for Dade Heritage Trust. So that was another one where we lost the building eventually, but we saved some of the artifacts, which are now on display in the Wilsonian and can be appreciated. And I know people that go there that let me know how beautiful those pieces are and how appreciative they were to be saved. So.
That's really great. It's always good to, these fights, there are wins and losses, and sometimes the losses can be disheartening, but trying to like find the silver linings in the dark clouds, the fact that the remnants of this building are still on display so prominently decades later. I have one more question for you before I let you go. And again, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Within historical preservation circles, there is this discussion about kind of place versus space, and the idea of kind of preserving something where it is versus movement and moving buildings to a new location, and whether the movement kind of destroys the historical connection or recontextualizes it. And I know obviously the number one priority is keep the thing in the place where it is. But particularly, I think in the last couple of decades, there's been a resistance to this kind of effort that we saw with the Brown House. What's your take on that? Because I feel like, especially with this example, that house was either getting moved or it was getting taken down, and there really wasn't a third option. And so I feel like sometimes folks in historical preservation lose the fact that decisions are being made outside the context of history. So just what are your in
Well,
after this event, what do you think about this debate?
listen, it's a great question and it's an important question. Okay, number one, you want certainly in the context of historical recognition, you want to keep things where they are. I mean, that is the primary point, is to keep something right where it belongs and right where it fits and right where it tells the story of why it's there. But then secondly, if that can't be done, and the item that we're talking about, the house, the building, or whatever it may be, the train station, is of importance in itself, of its architecture and what it says. And if it can be moved, then I think, of course, that's a fallback position. It's a fallback position. It should stay where it was located. But if it can't be, and it's worth saving it, not just for where it is, but also for what it is, then I mean, look at any museum. There's nothing in a museum that started in a museum. But if it weren't for museums holding all these wonderful things, whether it's natural history or built history or even stamp collections, if it weren't for museums, we would never have a knowledge of what had gone on or what had happened. So yes, we've moved things that are historical. We've moved things from Egypt to England, from Egypt to New York, and from Egypt all the way. We've moved things from Mesopotamia. I mean, But that has given us context of our lives and our civilizations. And so therefore, I think it's important to save certain things. And if you have to move it, you have to move it. It has to be the right move, obviously. It has to be to the right place to make sense of where it's going and why it's going there. So anyways, it's a great debate, and that's my take on it, is that you don't move it if you can save it where it is. But if it's worth seeing, worth our children and our grandchildren seeing it, then we have to save it to move it, move it to save it.
I think that's a great perspective. That idea of thinking about museums, like it's so obvious, but I actually hadn't thought about that. Like, yeah, museums have usefulness because these things have been moved when they can't be left in place. Don Slesnick, thank you. One, thank you for your time. Thank you for being a great guest, and thank you again for the decades and decades of work that you've put in to keep that thread of Miami history as intact as it possibly can be. It is greatly appreciated on my part, and I know on the part of my listeners as well.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you today. I thank you for having this discussion with me, and I appreciate what you're doing for all of us with your podcast. So thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You take care.
I want to take another moment and thank Mayor Don Slesnick for taking some time out of his day and talking to me about this really interesting moment and how it really impacted the thought of historical preservation in Miami, really for decades to come. It's just a wealth of knowledge, and I was glad he was able to share some of that with me and with us today. Secondly, Wolfson Archives, as always, the best. And for folks that are members of those Facebook groups that share so many great things, you have no idea how many times I see something and winds up becoming a jumping off point to a whole other episode that I had no idea about. So it really, whether you follow us at This Day Miami Pod on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or even you're just interested in Miami history and you follow some sort of Facebook group, I'm probably seeing it at some point. And I did want to give a specific shout out to the direct influence of this episode in the beginning, in the introduction. So again, thank you just for being interested in Miami history. Lastly, I want to thank one person in particular and kind of for an unusual reason. But I do think it's important and I do want it to be evidence that I really do want feedback from the listeners of this show and I really do appreciate it. I received an Instagram comment last month from a Patricia Lilavoie. Patricia, please forgive me if I'm butchering that name, but I think I have it right. On a reel that I shared about our Miami Vice episode, and it wasn't positive. But I could tell that as a follower, she really cared about the show. And she had some feedback about the Miami Vice episode that I thought was heartfelt and meaningful. And I really took it to heart, and I wanted to hear more about it. And we engaged in a wonderful back and forth through Instagram and then through email. And I heard her out, and I understood where she was coming from. Some things I agreed with her wholeheartedly. Some other things I thought that, circumstance kind of dictated some things that were outside of my control. But it's a good reminder that, the whole reason why this show exists is for people to listen to it. So if you have constructive criticism, if you have praise, if you have anything that you feel like you want to share, don't be a stranger. Follow us and jump in the comments on social media at This Day Miami Pod, or send me an email, thisdaymiamipod@gmail.com. I really do want to hear it. There is a small but mighty listener base of this program, and I greatly, greatly appreciate it. And hearing your direct feedback lets me know what you guys like, what you don't, what can be better, what. If something can't be better, I owe you an explanation as to why it can't. All those things. So again, at This Day Miami Pod on pretty much every major social media platform, and thisdaymiamipod@gmail.com. And yeah, I really do hope to hear from you soon. Make sure you follow us on your preferred social media platform. Make sure you follow the show on your preferred podcast provider, whether that's Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you've done all that already, be sure to leave us a five-star review on your preferred podcast platform. It really does help the show attract new listeners. So that'll do it for this month. As always, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next month with another episode. And until next time, I've been Matthew Bunch. The high times.